Sir Axel added. Stannis looked at them with annoyance. Are you trained crows to croak at me in turns? Enough!
Husband, hear me,
the queen entreated. Why? Two is not three. Kings can count as well as smugglers. You may go. Stannis turned his back on them. Melisandre helped the queen to her feet. Selyse swept stiffly from the chamber, the red woman trailing behind. Sir Axel lingered long enough to give Davos one last look.
An ugly look and an ugly face, he thought as he met the stare.
After the others had gone, Davos cleared his throat. The king looked up. Why are you still here?
Sire, about Edric Storm.
Stannis made a sharp gesture.
Spare me.
Davos persisted.
Your daughter takes her lessons with him, and plays with him every day in Aegon's garden.
I know that.
Her heart would break if anything ill should.
I know that as well.
If you would only see him.
I have seen him.
He looks like Robert.
Aye, and worships him.
Shall I tell him how often his beloved father ever gave him a thought? My brother liked the making of children well enough, but after birth they were a bother.
He asks after you every day. He...
You're making me angry, Davos. I will hear no more of this bastard boy.
His name is Edric Storm, sire.
I know his name. Was there ever a name so apt?
It proclaims his bastardy, his high birth, and the turmoil he brings with him. Edric Storm. There, I've said it.
Are you satisfied, my lord Hand?
Edric,
he started,
is one boy. He may be the best boy who ever drew breath, and it would not matter. My duty is to the realm.
His hand swept across the painted table.
How many boys dwell in Westeros? How many girls? How many men? How many women? The darkness will devour them all, she says. The night that never ends. She talks of prophecies. A hero reborn in the sea, living dragons hatched from dead stone. She speaks of signs, and swears they point at me.
I never asked for this, no more than I asked to be king.
Yet dare I disregard her?
He ground his teeth.
We do not choose our destinies, yet we must do our duty. No, great or small, we must do our duty. Melisandre swears that she has seen me in her flames, facing the dark, with Lightbringer raised on high. Lightbringer!
Stannis gave a derisive snort.
Cheh!
It glimmers prettily, I'll grant you, but on the Blackwater this magic sword served me no better than any common steel. A dragon would have turned that battle. Aegon once stood here, as I do, looking down on this table. Do you think we would name him Aegon the Conqueror today, if he had not had dragons?
Your grace, said Davos, the cost.
I know the cost.
Last night, gazing into that hearth, I saw things in the flames as well. I saw a king, a crown of fire on his brows, burning. Burning, Davos. His own crown consumed his flesh and turned him into ash. Do you think I need Melisandre to tell me what that means? Or you?
The king moved so his shadow fell upon King's Landing.
If Joffrey should die, what is the life of one bastard boy against a kingdom?
Everything, said Davos softly.
Stannis looked at him, jaw clenched.
Go,
the king said at last, before you talk yourself back into the dungeon. Sometimes the storm winds blow so strong, a man has no choice but to furl his sails.
Aye, your grace.
Davos bowed, but Stannis had seemingly forgotten him already. It was chilly in the yard when he left the stone drum. A wind blew briskly from the east, making the banner snap and flap noisily along the walls. Davos could smell salt in the air.
The sea.
He loved that smell. It made him want to walk a deck again, to raise his canvas and sail off south to Maria and his two small ones. He thought of them most every day now, and even more at night. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to take Devon and go home.
I cannot,
Not yet. I am a lord now, and the king's hand. I must not fail him.
He raised his eyes to gaze up at the walls. In place of Merlin's, 1,000 grotesques and gargoyles looked down on him, each different from all the others. Wyverns, griffins, demons, manticores, minotaurs, basilisks, hellhounds, cockatrices, and 1,000 queerer creatures sprouted from the castle's battlements as if they'd grown there. And the dragons were everywhere. The great hall was a dragon lying on its belly. Men entered through its open mouth. The kitchens were a dragon curled up in a ball, with the smoke and steam of the ovens vented through its nostrils. The towers were dragons hunched above the walls or poised for flight. The windworm seemed to scream defiance, while Sea Dragon Tower gazed serenely out across the waves. Smaller dragons framed the gates. Dragon claws emerged from walls to grasp at torches. Great stone wings enfolded the smith and armory, and tails formed arches, bridges, and exterior stairs. Davos had often heard it said that the wizards of Valyria did not cut and chisel, as common masons did, but work stone with fire and magic, as a potter might work clay. But now he wondered.
What if they were real dragons, somehow turned to stone? If the Red Woman brings them to life, the castle will come crashing down, I'm thinking. What kind of dragons are full of rooms and stairs and furniture, and windows, and chimneys, and privy shafts?
Davos turned to find Salador San beside him.
Does this mean you have forgiven my treachery, Salar?
The old pirate wagged a finger at him.
Forgiving, yes. Forgetting, no. All that good gold on Claw Isle, that might have been mine. It makes me tired and old to think of it. When I die impoverished, my wives and my concubines will curse you, Onion Lord. Lord Celtigar had many fine wines that now I am not tasting. A sea eagle he had trying to fly from the wrist, and a magic horn to summon krakens from the deep. Very useful such a horn would be to pull down Tairashi and other vexing creatures. But do I have this horn to blow? No, because the king made my old friend, his hand.
He slipped his arm through Davos's and said,
"The queen's men love you not, old friend. I am hearing that a certain hand has been making friends of his own. This is true, yes. You err too much, you old pirate."
A smuggler had best know men as well as tides, or he would not live to smuggle long. The queen's men might remain fervent followers of the Lord of Light, but the lesser folk of Dragonstone were drifting back to the gods they'd known all their lives. They said Stannis was ensorcelled, that Melisandre had turned him away from the Seven to bow before some demon out of shadow and, worst sin of all, that she and her god had failed him. And there were knights and lordlings who felt the same. Davos had sought them out, choosing them with the same care with which he had once picked his crews. Sir Gerald Gower had fought stoutly on the Blackwater, but afterward had been heard to say that R'hllor must be a feeble god to let his followers be chased off by a dwarf and a dead man. Sir Andrew Estamont was the king's cousin and had served as his squire years ago. The bastard of Nightsong had commanded the rear guard that allowed Stannis to reach the safety of Salador San's galleys, but he worshipped the warrior with a faith as fierce as he was.
King's men, not queen's men.
But it would not do to boast of them.
A certain Lycene pirate once told me that a good smuggler stays out of sight,
Davos replied carefully.
Black sails, muffled oars, and a crew that knows how to hold their tongues.
The Lycene laughed.
A crew with no tongues is even better, eh? Big, stronger mutes who cannot read or write.
But then he grew more somber.
But I am glad to know that someone watches your back, old friend. Will the king give the boy to the Red Priestess, do you think? One little dragon could end this great big war.
Old habit made him reach for his luck, but his finger bones no longer hung about his neck, and he found nothing.
He will not do it, said Davos. "He could not harm his own blood. Lord Renly will be glad to hear this. Renly was a traitor in arms. Edric Storm is innocent of any crime. His Grace is a just man."
Sala shrugged.
"Well, we shall be seeing, or you shall. For myself, I am returning to sea. Even now, rascally smugglers may be sailing across the Blackwater Bay, hoping to avoid paying their lord's lawful duties."
He slapped Davos on the back.
"Take care. You, with your mute friends, you are grown so very great now. Yet the higher a man climbs, the farther he has to fall."
Davos reflected on those words as he climbed the steps of Sea Dragon Tower to the maester's chambers below the rookery. He did not need Sala to tell him he had risen too high.
"I cannot read. I cannot write. The lords despise me. I know nothing of ruling. How can I be the king's hand? I belong on the deck of a ship, not in a castle tower."
He had said as much to Maester Pylos. "You are a notable captain," the maester replied. "A captain rules his ship, does he not? He must navigate treacherous waters, set his sails to catch the rising wind, know when a storm is coming, and how best to weather it. This is much the same." Pylos meant it kindly, but his assurances rang hollow.
"It's not at all the same," Davos had protested. "A kingdom's not a ship, and a good thing, or this kingdom would be sinking. I know wood and rope and water, yes, but how will that serve me now? Where do I find the wind to blow King Stannis to his throne?"
The maester laughed at that. "And there you have it, my lord. Words are wind, you know, and you've blown mine away with your good sense. His Grace knows what he has in you, I think."
"Onions," said Davos glumly. "That is what he has in me. The king's hand should be a high-born lord, someone wise and learned, a battle commander or a great knight."
Sir Ryan Redwine was the greatest knight of his day, and one of the worst hands ever to serve a king. Septon Murmison's prayers worked miracles, but his hand, he soon had the whole realm praying for his death.
Lord Butterwell was renowned for wit, Miles Smallwood for courage, Sir Otto Hightower for learning. Yet they failed as hands, every one. As for birth, the Dragon Kings oft chose hands from amongst their own blood, with the results as various as Baelor Breakspear and Maegor the Cruel. Against this you have Septon Barth, the blacksmith's son the old king plucked from the Red Keep's library, who gave the realm 40 years of peace and plenty. Pylos smiled. "Read your history, Lord Davos, and you will see that your doubts are groundless."
"How can I read history when I cannot read?"
"Any man can read, my lord," said Maester Pylos. "There is no magic needed, nor high birth. I'm teaching the art to your son at the king's command. Let me teach you as well." It was a kindly offer, and not one that Davos could refuse. And so every day he repaired to the maester's chambers, high atop Sea Dragon Tower, to frown over scrolls and parchments and great leather tomes, and try to puzzle out a few more words. His efforts often gave him headaches, and made him feel as big a fool as Patchface, besides. His son Devon was not yet 12, yet he was well ahead of his father. And for Princess Shireen and Edric Storm, reading seemed as natural as breathing. When it came to books, Davos was more a child than any of them. Yet he persisted. He was the king's hand now, and a king's hand should read. The narrow, twisting steps of Sea Dragon Tower had been a sore trial to Maester Cresson after he broke his hip. Davos still found himself missing the old man. He thought Stannis must as well. Pylos seemed clever and diligent and well-meaning, but he was so young, and the king did not confide in him as he had in Cresson. The old man had been with Stannis so long, until he ran afoul of Melisandre and died for it. At the top of the steps, Davos heard a soft jingle of bells that could only herald Patchface. The princess's fool was waiting outside the maester's door for her like a faithful hound. Doe soft and slump-shouldered, his broad face
tattooed in a motley pattern of red and green squares. Patchface wore a helm made of a rack of deer antlers strapped to a tin bucket. A dozen bells hung from the tines and rang when he moved, which meant constantly, since the fool seldom stood still. He jingled and jangled his way everywhere he went. Small wonder that Pylos had exiled him from Shireen's lessons.
"Under the sea, the old fish eat the young fish,"
the fool muttered at Davos. He bobbed his head, and his bells clanged and chimed and sang,
I know, oh ho ho.
"Up here, the young fish teach the old fish," said Davos, who never felt so ancient as when he sat down to try and read. It might have been different if aged Maester Cresson had been the one teaching him, but Pylos was young enough to be his son. He found the maester seated at his long wooden table, covered with books and scrolls, across from the three children. Princess Shireen sat between the two boys. Even now Davos could take great pleasure in the sight of his own blood keeping company with a princess and a king's bastard.
"Davin will be a lord now, not merely a knight. The Lord of the Rainwood."
Davos took more pride in that than in wearing the title himself.
"He reads, too. He reads and he writes, as if he'd been born to it."
Pylos had naught but praise for his diligence, and the master-at-arms, said Devon, was showing promise, with sword and lance as well.
"And he is a godly lad, too."
"My brothers have ascended to the Hall of Light to sit beside the Lord,"
Devon had said when his father told him how his four elder brothers had died.
"I will pray for them at the night fires, and for you as well, father, so you might walk in the light of the Lord till the end of your days."
"Good morrow to you, father," the boy greeted him.
"He looks so much like Dale did at his age,"
Davos thought. His elders had never dressed so fine as Devon in his squire's raiment, to be sure, but they shared the same square, plain face, the same forthright brown eyes, the same thin brown flyaway hair. Devon's cheeks and chin were dusted with blonde hair, a fuzz that would have shamed a proper peach, though the boy was fiercely proud of his beard,
just as Dale was proud of his once.
Devon was the oldest of the three children at the table. Yet Edric Storm was 3 inches taller and broader in the chest and shoulders. He was his father's son in that, nor did he ever miss a morning's work with sword and shield. Those old enough to have known Robert and Renly as children said that the bastard boy had more of their look than Stannis had ever shared. The coal-black hair, the deep blue eyes, the mouth, the jaw, the cheekbones. Only his ears reminded you that his mother had been a Florent.
"Yes, good morrow, my lord," Edric echoed.
The boy could be fierce and proud, but the maesters and castellans and masters-at-arms who'd raised him had schooled him well in courtesy.
"Do you come for my uncle? How fares his grace?"
"Well,"
Davos lied. If truth be told, the king had a haggard, haunted look about him, but he saw no need to burden the boy with his fears.
"I hope I have not disturbed your lesson."
"We had just finished, my lord," Maester Pylos said. "We were reading about King Daeron the First."
Princess Shireen was a sad, sweet, gentle child, far from pretty. Stannis had given her his square jaw and Selyse her florent ears, and the guards in their cruel wisdom had seen fit to compound her homeliness by afflicting her with grayscale in the cradle. The disease had left one cheek and half her neck grey and cracked and hard, though it had spared both her life and her sight.
"He went to war and conquered Dawn, the young dragon, they called him."
"He worshipped false gods," said Devon, "but he was a great king otherwise, and very brave in battle."
"He was," agreed Edric Storm, "but my father was braver. The young dragon never won 3 battles in a day."
The princess looked at him wide-eyed.
"Did Uncle Robert win 3 battles in a day?"
The bastard nodded.
"It was when he'd first come home to call his banners.
Lords Grandison, Caffrin, and Fell planned to join their strength at Summerhall and march on Storm's End. But he learned their plans from an informer and rode at once with all his knights and squires.
As the plotters came up on Summerhall, one by one, he defeated each of them in turn before they could join up with the others. He slew Lord Fell in single combat and captured his son, Silver Axe. Devon looked to Pylos.
Is that how it happened?
I said so, didn't I? Edric Storm said before the maester could reply. He smashed all three of them and fought so bravely that Lord Grandison and Lord Caffarine became his men afterwards, and Silver Axe too. No one ever beat my father.
Edric, you ought not to boast, Maester Pylos said. King Robert suffered defeats like any other man. Lord Tyrell bested him at Ashford, and he lost many a tawny tilt as well.
He won more than he lost, though, and he killed Prince Rhaegar on the Trident.
That he did, the maester agreed. But now I must give my attention to Lord Davos, who has waited so patiently. We will read more of King Daeron's conquest of Dorne on the morrow.
Princess Shireen and the boy said their farewells courteously. When they had taken their leaves, Maester Pylos moved closer to Davos.
My lord, perhaps you would like to try a bit of conquest of Dorne as well.
He slid the slender leather-bound book across the table. King Daeron wrote with an elegant simplicity, and his history is rich with blood, battle, and bravery. Your son is quite engrossed.
My son is not quite 12. I am the king's hand. Give me another letter, if you would.
As you wish, my lord.
Maester Pylos rummaged about his table, unrolling and then discarding various scraps of parchment.
There are no new letters, perhaps an old one.
Davos enjoyed a good story as well as any man, but Stannis had not named him hand for his enjoyment, he felt. His first duty was to help his king rule, and for that he must needs understand the words the ravens brought. The best way to learn a thing was to do it, he had found. Sails or scrolls, it made no matter.
This might serve our purpose.
Pylos passed him a letter. Davos flattened down the little square of crinkled parchment and squinted at the tiny, crabbed letters. Reading was hard on the eyes, that much he had learned early. Sometimes he wondered if the Citadel offered a champion's purse to the maester who wrote the smallest hand. Pylos had laughed at the notion, but...
To the five kings, read Davos, hesitating briefly over five, which he did not often see written out. The king be where?
Beyond, the maester corrected. Davos grimaced.
The king beyond the wall comes south. He leads a vast host of wildlings. Lord Mormont sent a raven from the haunted forest.
Pylos underlined the words with the point of his finger.
The haunted forest. He is under attack.
Yes. Pleased, he ploughed onward.
Arthur. Birds have come since with no words. We fear Mormont slain with all his tench. No strength. We fear Mormont slain with all his strength.
Davos suddenly realized just what he was reading. He turned the letter over and saw that the wax that had sealed it had been black.
This is from the Night's Watch. Maester, has King Stannis seen this letter?
I brought it to Lord Alistair when it first arrived. He was the hand then. I believed he discussed it with the Queen. When I asked him if he wished to send a reply, he told me not to be a fool. His Grace lacks the men to fight his own battles. He has none to waste on wildlings, he said to me.
Well, that was true enough, and this talk of five kings would certainly have angered Stannis.
"Only a starving man begs bread from a beggar," he muttered.
"Pardon, my lord?"
Something my wife once said.
Davis drummed his shortened fingers against the tabletop. The first time he had seen the wall, he had been younger than Devon, serving aboard the Cubblecat under Roro Euhorus, a Tyrushi known up and down the narrow sea as the Blind Bastard, though he was neither blind nor base-born. Roro had sailed past Skagus into the shivering sea, visiting 100 little coves that had never seen a trading ship before. He brought steel, swords, axes, helms, good chainmail hauberks to trade for furs, ivory, amber, and obsidian. When the Cubblecat turned back south, her holds were stuffed, but in the Bay of Seals, three black galleys came out to herd her into Eastwatch. They lost their cargo, and the bastard lost his head, for the crime of trading weapons to the wildlings. Davis had traded at Eastwatch in his smuggling days. The Black Brothers made hard enemies but good customers, for a ship with the right cargo. But while he may have taken their coin, he never forgot how the Blind Bastard's head had rolled across the Cobblecat's deck.
"I met some wildlings when I was a boy," he told Maester Pylos. "They were fair thieves, but bad hagglers. One made off with our cabin girl. All in all, they seem men like any other men, some fair, some foul."
"Men are men," Maester Pylos agreed. "Shall we return to our reading, my Lord Hand?"
"I am the Hand of the King, yes."
Stannis might be the King of Westeros in name, but in truth he was King of the Painted Table. He held Dragonstone and Storm's End, and had an ever more uneasy alliance with Salador San, but that was all. How could the Watch have looked to him for help?
"They may not know how weak he is, how lost his cause." "King Stannis never saw this letter. You're quite certain? Nor Melisande?"
"No. Should I bring it to them, even now?"
"No," Davos said at once. "You did your duty when you brought it to Lord Alistair." If Melisande knew of this letter, what was it she had said? "One whose name may not be spoken is marshalling his powers, Davos Seaworth. Soon comes a cold and a night that never ends."
And Stannis had seen a vision in the flames, a ring of torches in the snow with terror all around. "My lord, are you unwell?" asked Pylos.
"I am frightened, maester,"
he might have said. Davos was remembering a tale Salador San had told him, of how Azor Ahai tempered Lightbringer by thrusting it through the heart of the wife he loved.
"He slew his wife to fight the dark. If Stannis's Azor Ahai come again, does that mean Edric Storm must play the part of Nisir Nisir?" "I was thinking, maester, my pardons. What harm if some wildling king conquers the north?"
It was not as though Stannis held the north. His grace could scarcely be expected to defend people who refused to acknowledge him as king.
"Give me another letter," he said abruptly. "This one is too
difficult," suggested Pylos.
"Soon comes the cold," whispered Melisande, "and the night that never ends."
"Troubling," said Davos. "Too troubling. A different letter, please."
Tyrion. Pod dressed him for his ordeal in a plush velvet tunic of Lannister crimson and brought him his chain of office. Tyrion left it on the bedside table. His sister misliked being reminded that he was the king's hand, and he did not wish to inflame the relations between them any further. Varys caught up with him as he was crossing the yard.
"My lord," he said, a little out of breath, "you had best read this at once."
He held out a parchment in a soft white hand.
"A report from the north."
"Good news or bad?" Tyrion asked.
"That is not for me to judge."
Tyrion unrolled the parchment. He had to squint to read the words in the torchlit yard.
"Gods be good," he said softly.
both of them?
I fear so, my lord. It's so sad, so grievous sad. And them so young and innocent. Tyrion remembered how the wolves had howled when the Stark boy had fallen.
Are they howling now, I wonder?
Have you told anyone else? He asked. Not as yet, though of course I must. He rolled up the letter. I'll tell my sister. He wanted to see how she took the news. He wanted that very much. The queen looked especially lovely that night. She wore a low-cut gown of deep green velvet that brought out the colour of her eyes. Her golden hair tumbled over her bare shoulders, and around her waist was a woven belt studded with emeralds. Tyrion waited until he had been seated and served a cup of wine before thrusting the letter at her. He said not a word. Cersei blinked at him innocently and took the parchment from his hand.
"I trust you're pleased," he said as she read. "You wanted the Stark boy dead, I believe."
Cersei made a sour face. "It was Jaime who threw him from that window, not me." "For love," he said, as if that would please me. It was a stupid thing to do, and dangerous besides. But when did our sweet brother ever stop to think? "The boy saw you," Tyrion pointed out. "He was a child. I could have frightened him into silence." She looked at the letter thoughtfully. "Why must I suffer accusations every time some Stark stubs his toe? This was Greyjoy's work. I had nothing to do with it."
"Let us hope Lady Catelyn believes that."
Her eyes widened. "She wouldn't..."
"Kill Jaime? Why not?"
"What would you do if Joffrey and Tommen were murdered?" "I still hold Sansa," the queen declared.
"We still hold Sansa," he corrected her, "and we had better take good care of her. Now, where is this supper you've promised me, sweet sister?"
Cersei set a tasty table. That could not be denied. They started with a creamy chestnut soup, crusty hot bread, and greens dressed with apples and pine nuts. Then came lamprey pie, honeyed ham, buttered carrots, white beans and bacon, and roast swan stuffed with mushrooms and oysters. Tyrion was exceedingly courteous. He offered his sister the choice portions of every dish and made certain he ate only what she did. Not that he truly thought she'd poison him, but it never hurt to be careful. The news about the Starks had soured her, he could see. "We've had no news from Bitterbridge?" she asked anxiously, as she speared a bit of apple on the point of her dagger and ate it with small, delicate bites.
"None."
"I've never trusted Littlefinger. For enough coin, he'd go over to Stannis in a heartbeat."
"Stannis Baratheon is too bloody righteous to buy men. Nor would he make a comfortable lord for the likes of Pataya. This war has made for some queer bedfellows, I agree, but those two, no."
As he carved some slices off the ham, she said, "We have Lady Tanda to thank for the pig."
"A token of her love?"
"A bribe. She begs leave to return to her castle. Your leave as well as mine. I suspect she fears you'll arrest her on the road, as you did Lord Giles."
"Does she plan to make off with the heir to the throne?"
Tyrion served his sister a cut of ham and took one for himself.
"I'd sooner she remain. If she wants to feel safe, tell her to bring down her garrison from Stokeworth, as many men as she has."
"If we need men so badly, why did you send away your savages?" A certain testiness crept into Cersei's voice.
"It was the best use I could have made of them," he told her truthfully. "They're fierce warriors, but not soldiers. In formal battle, discipline is more important than courage. They've already done us more good in the Kingswood than they would ever have done us on the city walls."
As the swan was being served, the queen questioned him about the conspiracy of the Antler men. She seemed more annoyed than afraid. "Why are we plagued with so many treasons? What injury has House Lannister ever done these wretches?"
"None," said Tyrion. "But they think to be on the winning side, which makes them fools as well as traitors."
"Are you certain you've found them all?"
"Varys says so."
The swan was too rich for his taste.
A line appeared on Cersei's pale white brow between those lovely eyes. You put too much trust in that eunuch. He serves me well, or so he'd have you believe. You think you're the only one he whispers secrets to? He gives each of us just enough to convince us that we'd be helpless without him. He played the same game with me when I first wed Robert. For years I was convinced I had no truer friend at court, but now... She studied his face for a moment. He says you mean to take the hound from Joffrey.
Damn Varys.
I need Clegane for more important duties. Nothing is more important than the life of the king. The life of the king is not at risk. Joff will have brave Sir Osmond guarding him, and Meryn Trant as well.
Are they good for nothing better?
I need Balon Swan and Hound to lead sorties, to make certain Stannis gets no toehold on our side of the Blackwater. Jaime would lead the sorties himself. From River Run? That's quite a sortie. Joff's only a boy. A boy who wants to be part of this battle, and for once he's showing some sense. I don't intend to put him in the thick of the fighting, but he needs to be seen. Men fight more fiercely for a king who shares their peril than one who hides behind his mother's skirts.
He's 13, Tyrion.
Remember Jaime at 13? If you want the boy to be his father's son, let him play the part. Joff wears the finest armor gold can buy, and he'll have a dozen gold cloaks around him at all times. If the city looks to be in the least danger of falling, I'll have him escorted back to the Red Keep at once.
He had thought that might reassure her, but he saw no sign of pleasure in those green eyes.
Will the city fall?
No.
But if it does, I pray that we can hold the Red Keep long enough for our Lord Father to march to our relief.
You've lied to me before, Tyrion.
Always with good reason, sweet sister. I want amity between us as much as you do. I've decided to release Lord Giles. He had kept Giles safe for just this gesture. You can have Sir Burrus Blunt back as well.
The Queen's mouth tightened.
Sir Burrus can rot at Rosby, she said. But Tommen stays where he is. He's safer under Lord Jaslyn's protection than he would ever have been with Lord Giles.
Serving men cleared away the swan, hardly touched. Cersei beckoned for the suite.
I hope you like blackberry tarts.
I love all sorts of tarts.
Oh, I've known that a long while. Do you know why Varys is so dangerous? Are we playing at riddles now?
No.
He doesn't have a cock. Neither do you.
And don't you just hate that, Cersei?
Perhaps I'm dangerous, too. You, on the other hand, are as big a fool as every other man. That worm between your legs does half your thinking.
Tyrion licked the crumbs off his fingers. He did not like his sister's smile.
Yes, and just now my worm is thinking that perhaps it is time I took my leave.
Are you unwell, brother?
She leaned forward, giving him a good look at the top of her breasts.
Suddenly you appear somewhat flustered.
Flustered?
Tyrion glanced at the door.
He thought he'd heard something outside.
He was beginning to regret coming here alone.
You've never shown much interest in my cock before.
It's not your cock that interests me so much as what you stick it in.
I don't depend on the eunuch for everything as you do. I have my own ways of finding out things, especially things that people don't want me to know.
What are you trying to say?
Only this.
I have your little whore.
Tyrion reached for his wine cup, buying a moment to gather his thoughts.
I thought men were more to your taste.
Oh, you're such a droll little fellow. Tell me, have you married this one yet?
When he gave her no answer, she laughed and said,
Father will be ever so relieved.
His belly felt as if it were full of eels.
How had she found Shay? Had Varys betrayed him? Or had all his precautions been undone by his impatience the night he rode directly to the manse?
Why should you care who I choose to warm my bed?
A Lannister always pays his debt, she said. You've been scheming against me since the day you came to King's Landing. You sold Myrcella, stole Tommen, and now you plot to have Joff killed. You want him dead, so you can rule through Tommen.
Well, I can't say that notion isn't tempting. This is madness, Cersei. Stannis will be here in days. You need me.
For what? Your great prowess in battle?
Bronze cell swords will never fight without me,
he lied. Oh, I think they will. It's your goal they love, not your impish wit. Have no fear, though. They won't be without you. I won't say I haven't thought of slitting your throat from time to time, but Jaime would never forgive me if I did.
And the whore?
He would not call her by name.
If I can convince her she means nothing to me, perhaps.
She'll be treated gently enough, so long as no harm comes to my sons. If Joff should be killed, however, or if Tommen should fall into the hands of our enemies, your little cunt will die more painfully than you can possibly imagine.
She truly believes I mean to kill my own nephew.
The boys are safe, he promised her wearily.
Gods be good, Cersei, they're my own blood. What sort of man do you take me for?
A small and twisted one. Tyrion stared at the dregs on the bottom of his wine cup.
What would Jaime do in my place? Kill the bitch, most likely, and worry about the consequences afterward.
But Tyrion did not have a golden sword, nor the skill to wield one. He loved his brother's reckless wrath, but it was their Lord Father he must try and emulate.
Stone. I must be stone. I must be Casterly rock, hard and unmovable. If I fail this test, I had as leave seek out the nearest grotesquerie.
For all I know, you've killed her already, he said. Would you like to see her? I thought you might. Cersei crossed the room and threw open the heavy oaken door. Bring in my brother's whore. Sir Osmond's brothers, Osney and Osfred, were peas from the same pod, tall men with hooked noses, dark hair, and cruel smiles. She hung between them, eyes wide and white in her dark face. Blood trickled from her broken lip, and he could see bruises through her torn clothing. Her hands were bound with rope, and they'd gagged her so she could not speak. You said she wouldn't be hurt.
She fought.
Unlike his brothers, Osney Kettleblack was clean-shaven, so the scratches showed plainly on his bare cheeks.
Got claws like a shadow cat, this one.
Bruises heal, said Cersei in a bored tone. The whore will live, so long as Joff does. Tyrion wanted to laugh at her. It would have been so sweet, so very sweet. But it would have given the game away. You've lost, Cersei.
And the Kettleblacks are even bigger fools than Bronn claimed.
All he needed to do was say the words. Instead, he looked at the girl's face and said,
You swear you'll release her after the battle?
If you release Tommen, yes. He pushed himself to his feet.
Keep her then, but keep her safe. If these animals think they can use her. Well, sweet sister, let me point out that a scale tips two ways.
His tone was calm, flat, uncaring. He'd reached for his father's voice and found it.
Whatever happens to her, happens to Tommen as well. And that includes the beatings and rapes. If she thinks me such a monster, I'll play the part for her.
Cersei had not expected that. You would not dare. Tyrion made himself smile, slow and cold. Green and black, his eyes laughed at her.
Dare? I'll do it myself.
His sister's hand flashed at his face, but he caught her wrist and bent it back until she cried out. Osfred moved to her rescue.
One more step, and I'll break her arm,
the dwarf warned him. The man stopped.
You remember when I said you'd never hit me again, Cersei?
He shoved her to the floor and turned back to the Kettleblacks.
Untie her and remove that gag.
The rope had been so tight as to cut off the blood to her hands.
She cried out in pain as the circulation returned. Tyrion massaged her fingers gently until feeling returned.
"Sweetling," he said, "you must be brave. I am sorry they hurt you. I know you'll free me, my lord."
"I will," he promised. And Alla Yaya bent over and kissed him on the brow. Her broken lip left a smear of blood on his forehead. "A bloody kiss is more than I deserve," Tyrion thought. "She would never have been hurt but for me." Her blood still marked him as he looked down at the queen. "I have never liked you, Cersei, but you were my own sister, so I never did you harm. You've ended that. I will hurt you for this. I don't know how yet, but give me time. A day will come when you think yourself safe and happy, and suddenly your joy will turn to ashes in your mouth, and you'll know the debt is paid." In war, his father had told him once, the battle is over in the instant one army breaks and flees. No matter that they're as numerous as they were a moment before, still armed and armored, once they had run before you, they would not turn to fight again. So it was with Cersei. "Get out," was all the answer she could summon. "Get out of my sight." Tyrion bowed. "Good night, then, and pleasant dreams." He made his way back to the Tower of the Hand, with 1,000 armored feet marching through his skull. "I ought to have seen this coming the first time I slipped through the back of Shataya's wardrobe." Perhaps he had not wanted to see. His legs were aching badly by the time he had made the climb. He sent Pod for a flagon of wine and pushed his way into his bedchamber. Shay sat cross-legged in the canopied bed, nude but for the heavy golden chain that looped across the swell of her breasts, a chain of linked golden hands, each clasping the next. Tyrion had not expected her. "What are you doing here?" Laughing, she stroked the chain.
"I wanted some hands on my titties, but these little gold ones are cold."
For a moment, he did not know what to say. How could he tell her that another woman had taken the beating meant for her, and might well die in her place, should some mischance of battle fell Joffrey? He wiped Alla Yaya's blood from his brow with the heel of his hand.
"The Lady Lullis? She's asleep. Sleeps all she ever wants to do, the great cow. She sleeps, and she eats. Sometimes she falls asleep while she's eating. The food falls under the blankets, and she rolls in it, and I have to clean her." She made a disgusted face. "All they did was fuck her.
Her mother says she's sick.
She has a baby in her belly, that's all."
Tyrion gazed around the room. Everything seemed much as he left it. "How did you enter? Show me the hidden door." She gave a shrug.
"Lord Varys made me wear a hood I couldn't see. Except there was one place I got a peep at the floor out of the bottom of the hood. It was all tiles, you know, the kind that make a picture."
"A mosaic," she nodded.
"They were coloured, red and black. I think the picture was a dragon. Otherwise, everything was dark. We went down a ladder and walked a long ways until I was all twisted about. Once we stopped so he could unlock an iron gate. I brushed against it when we went through. The dragon was past the gate. Then we went up another ladder with a tunnel at the top. I had to stoop, and I think Lord Varys was crawling."
Tyrion made a round of the bedchamber. One of the sconces looked loose. He stood on his toes and tried to turn it. It revolved slowly, scraping against the stone wall. When it was upside down, the stub of the candle fell out. The rushes, scattered across the cold stone floor, did not show any particular disturbance.
"Doesn't my lord want to bed me?" asked Shay. "In a moment."
Tyrion threw open his wardrobe, shoving his clothing aside, and pushed against the rear panel. What worked for a whorehouse might work for a castle as well. But no, the wood was solid, unyielding. A stone beside the window seat drew his eye, but all his tugging and prodding went for naught. He returned to the bed,
frustrated and annoyed. Shea undid his laces and threw her arms around his neck.
"Your shoulders feel as hard as rocks," she murmured. "Hurry, I want to feel you inside me."
Yet as her legs locked around his waist, his manhood left him. When she felt him go soft, Shea slid down under the sheets and took him in her mouth. But even that could not rouse him. After a few moments, he stopped her.
"What's wrong?"
she asked. All the sweet innocence of the world was written there in the lines of her young face.
"Innocence? Fool, she's a whore.
Sassy was right. You think with your cock. Fool. Fool." "Just go to sleep, sweetling," he urged, stroking her hair. Yet long after Shea had taken his advice, Tyrion himself still lay awake, his fingers cupped over one small breast, as he listened to her breathing. Catelyn. The great hall of Riverrun was a lonely place for two to sit at supper. Deep shadows draped the walls. One of the torches had guttered out, leaving only three. Catelyn sat staring into her wine goblet. The vintage tasted thin and sour on her tongue. Brienne was across from her. Between them, her father's high seat was as empty as the rest of the hall. Even the servants were gone. She had given them leave to join the celebration. The walls of the keep were thick, yet even so, they could hear the muffled sounds of revelry from the yard outside. Sir Desmond had brought 20 casks up from the cellars, and the small folk were celebrating Edmure's imminent return and Rob's conquest of the crag by hoisting horns of nut-brown ale. "I cannot blame them," Catelyn thought. "They do not know. And if they did, why should they care? They never knew my sons. Never watched Bran climb with their hearts in their throats. Pride and terror so mingled, they seemed to be as one. Never heard him laugh. Never smiled to see Rickon trying so fiercely to be like his older brothers." She stared at the supper set before her. Trout wrapped in bacon. Salad of turnip greens and red fennel and sweet grass, peas and onions, and hot bread. Brienne was eating methodically, as if supper were another chore to be accomplished. "I am become a sour woman," Catelyn thought. "I take no joy in mead nor meat, and song and laughter have become suspicious strangers to me. I am a creature of grief and dust and bitter longings. There is an empty place within me where my heart was once." The sound of the other woman's eating had become intolerable to her. "Brienne, I am no fit company. Go join the revels if you would. Drink a horn of ale and dance to Ryman's harping."
"I'm not made for revels, my lady."
Her big hands tore apart a heel of black bread. Brienne stared at the chunks as if she had forgotten what they were.
"If you command it, I..."
Catelyn could sense her discomfort.
"I only thought you might enjoy a happier company than mine." "I'm well content."
The girl used the bread to sup up some of the bacon grease the trout had been fried in. "There was another bird this morning." Catelyn did not know why she said it. "The maester woke me at once. That was dutiful, but not kind. Not kind at all." She had not meant to tell Brienne. No one knew but her and Maester Wyman, and she had meant to keep it that way until
what, foolish woman? Will holding it secret in your heart make it any less true? If you never tell, never speak of it, will it become only a dream? Less than a dream? A nightmare half remembered? Oh, if only the gods would be so good.
"Is it news of King's Landing?" asked Brienne.
"Would that it was. The bird came from Castle Serwyn, from Sir Roderick, my castellan.
dark wings, dark words.
He has gathered what power he could and is marching on Winterfell to take the castle back. How unimportant all that sounded now. But he said, he wrote, he told me,
"My lady, what is it? Is it some news of your sons?"
Such a simple question that was. Would that the answer could be as simple. When Catelyn tried to speak, the words caught in her throat. "I have no sons but Rob." She managed those terrible words without a sob. For that much she was glad. Brian looked at her with horror.
"My lady."
Bran and Rickon tried to escape, but were taken at a mill on the Acorn Water. Theon Greyjoy has mounted their heads on the walls of Winterfell. Theon Greyjoy, who ate at my table since he was a boy of 10. I have said it. Gods, forgive me. I have said it and made it true. Brienne's face was a watery blur. She reached across the table, but her finger stopped short of Catelyn's, as if the touch might be unwelcome.
There are no words, my lady, my good lady. Your sons, they're with the gods now.
Are they? Catelyn said sharply. What god would let this happen? Rickon was only a baby. How could he deserve such a death? And Bran, when I left the north, he had not opened his eyes since his fall. I had to go before he woke. Now I can never return to him or hear him laugh again. She showed Brienne her palms, her fingers. These scars. They send a man to cut Bran's throat as he lay sleeping. He would have died then, and me with him, but Bran's wolf tore out the man's throat. That gave her a moment's pause. I suppose Theon killed the wolves, too. He must have, elsewise. I was certain the boys would be safe so long as the dire wolves were with them, like Rob with his grey wind. But my daughters have no wolves now. The abrupt shift of topic left Brienne bewildered. Your daughters? Sansa was a lady at 3, always so courteous and eager to please. She loved nothing so well as tales of knightly valour. Men would say she had my look. But she will grow into a woman far more beautiful than I ever was. You can see that. I often sent away her maid so I could brush her hair myself. She had auburn hair, lighter than mine, and so thick and soft. The red in it would catch the light of the torches and shine like copper. And Arya, well, Ned's visitors would oft mistake her for a stable boy if they rode into the yard unannounced. Arya was a trial, it must be said. Half a boy and half a wolf pup. Forbid her anything, and it became her heart's desire. She had Ned's long face and brown hair that always looked as though a bird had been nesting in it. I despaired of ever making a lady of her. She collected scabs as other girls collect dolls, and would say anything that came into her head. I think she must be dead, too. When she said that, it felt as though a giant hand was squeezing her chest. I want them all dead, Brienne. Theon Greyjoy first, then Jaime Lannister and Cersei and the imp. Every one, every one. My girls will...
The queen, she has a little girl of her own, Brienne said awkwardly, and sons too of an age with yours. When she hears, perhaps she may take pity and
send my daughters back unharmed.
Catelyn smiled sadly. There is a sweet innocence about you, child. I could wish.
But no.
Rob will avenge his brothers. Ice can kill as dead as fire. Ice was Ned's greatsword, Valyrian steel, marked with the ripples of 1,000 foldings, so sharp
I fear to touch it. Rob's blade is dull as a cudgel compared to ice. It will not be easy for him to get Theon.